Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome, everybody, today. On our way to a conversation, I'll remind you, you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA-FM, the home of the Baltimore Blend, weekdays from 6 to 8 a.m., one of our great new shows here on the air that I have the pleasure of co-hosting once a month early in the morning at some local coffee house. Remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. We are going to have an analysis and discussion of President Barack Obama's State of the Union speech last night. It was a speech that some folks didn't think got really rousing until towards the end, but a lot was said during that speech, and we are going to analyze it with our guests. We are Fletcher Duane Wickham is with us, of course, the new chair, maybe not so new now, but chair of the communications department here at Morgan State University, also a columnist for USA Today, and a veteran political broadcaster in our country. Duane, always great to have you in the studio here.
Welcome. Thank you, Mark. Good to be back.
Tony Campbell's with us, professor of political science at Towson University, former leader of the Republican Party in Baltimore County.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Good to have you here, Tony. Margaret Flowers is with us. She's co-director of itsoureconomy.us, single-payer advocate and co-host of the radio program Clearing the Fog. Good to have you back in the studio, Margaret.
Thank you.
And Imara Jones joins us by phone, economic justice contributor for Color Lines, who served in the Clinton White House, where he worked on international trade policy and is also a former executive at Viacom. And Imara, welcome. Always good to have you with us, my friend.
Glad to be here.
So before we play clips, I just want to get your sense of it. I'm sure everybody watched it when we could break away from the Dornan case in California, which was pretty horrendous, which we talked about yesterday. But Duane, let me start with you. What your analysis of the speech?
I think people are going to talk a lot about what he said about guns with that flourish at the end.
Yes.
But I was struck by what he said about government, the role of government. He talked about better government. Almost as a choice between big government and small government, now we have this thing called better government. And I think that's where he's headed. That will be, I think, his vision for the next 4 years, how we offer better government, not less government, maybe not even more government, but better government to the American people.
Now, I'm going to come back to that point and analyze what that might mean. Tony?
Well, it's interesting. Better government can mean different things to different people. But the thing that I was kind of left with was that the president probably has 12 months of trying to get an agenda across. And he picked last night in the State of the Union to basically draw a line in the sand and pick a fight. Maybe that was prompted by Boehner's comment earlier in the day saying that the president didn't have courage kind of going off the handle on that. But the president definitely had a shot across the bow of the Republicans last night too, saying, this is where I think the country should be going, and here's the things that we should focus on, even things that drill down to the point of, they're going to have a college report card to basically say which universities to go to and which you should stay away from. That seems to be problematic as well. So, we'll see how this plays out over the next 12 months, but that's pretty much his political window.
Margaret Flowers.
I think, as usual, it was excellent political theater. He pretty much hit on all the points that he thought that people wanted to hear. There was a lot that he left out that could have been said. I think what it boils down to in the long run is, what we've seen from him. We need to go by what his deeds are, not by the words that he says. So, really it's going to be what comes out of this that's really concrete. We saw a few initiatives that seem a little new and bold. The election reform could be a potential real win. If we could go to universal voter registration in this country, that would be excellent. But, we'll see if he goes that far. So I think we need to take everything he said with a grain of salt and see what comes out of it in the months to come.
Imara Jones.
I mean, I thought that it was a speech at war with itself. On the one hand, he went wholesale into a launch of economic opportunity ideas that were not new and not bold, but were certainly noteworthy. But literally within 2 minutes, he opened the speech with that, and 2 minutes in, he pivoted in to the reality of sequestration and of looming budget cuts, a sequestration which he had agreed to and in part had set up with the Republicans in 2011 and then again in 2012. And so it was his ideals that were colliding with the reality of the compromises that he made. And sequestration is a very real possibility. And I felt that the speech actually was squandered a massive opportunity because it's the largest audience that he's going to have for the rest of the year. We have 3 months now, and actually nine weeks of impending budget crises. We've got sequestration first, and then there's a looming budget, a government shutdown, and then after that, there's a debt crisis, one on top of the other. What was needed was a way forward through all of this, and a part of that is him using the leverage of his office, the most powerful thing that he has, which is the bully pulpit, to make his case to the American people and to set forth terms for the coming debate. And that just wasn't done at all. And so as a result, I think Americans are going to be really surprised when in 15 days' time we go off the sequestration cliff, as it looks like is going to happen, which will then compound the difficulty of the other two things that I just mentioned. And so all of the ideals that he mentioned are going to fall right headlong into a very harsh reality. And there was nothing in his speech last night that got us hip to that, ready for that, or moved us off of where we are. And I think that he's going to look back on that and wish that that had been different.
So let me pick up on the first and last point made here for a moment. What Imara Jones just said and Duane Wickham, how you opened this program, how those two things fit together. What Imara sees as a kind of a lost opportunity, all the huge economic issues that confront President Barack Obama and the nation in the next few months that really were not addressed specifically, and what you picked out about a better government, nothing large or small. How does this fit together?
You know, my vision is shaped mostly by my own professional experiences. I've covered presidential campaigns since 1980, presidents since Jimmy Carter before 1980. And one of the things I find is that the presidents have significant power when they're willing to use it that will take them not just through the first year of their second term, but to the end of their second term. You know, the president said in this speech that he would do what he could with the Congress and suggested that he will do beyond more than that with his own executive power if he has to. A lot of opportunities missed, yeah, but it's a 6,000-word speech. I think what we'll see from this president is what we've seen from him before. The bully pulpit that he has, it's portable. He's going to take it on the road. I think, in fact, he's beginning this week to take it on the road. He's going to make his arguments as best he can. Politics is a messy business. And I think given an opportunity to redo it, as we call it in the game of golf, a mulligan, he would have done a lot of things differently, including that which he offered last night in the speech. But this president, I think, is determined to push his agenda, draw a line in the sand. I think beyond that, I think he's in fighting form. And I think he has the advantage of not having to stand for reelection. And the Congress, Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill and the House of Representatives, they're already in campaign mode.
As always, every 2 years.
As always.
They can't get out of campaign mode.
Absolutely.
Tony, you were about to say something.
Well, I just found that the wording that the president used last night, kind of in deference to Amari there, kind of prepared the American people for the cliffs that are going to happen. He talked about brinksmanship, which is, you know, for those of us that are political scientists, we, you know, kind of the Cold War kind of terminology, that there's going to be a Cold War, that there's going to be conflict. And then you follow up by saying that we have one manufacturer crisis after another, that you know, expect this conflict, expect that we're going to have probably a government shutdown. So he did prepare the American people in the State of the Union last night that this is going to happen. This is probably going to happen. But that he thinks that at the end of the day, after all these crises kind of comes and goes and looms, that what he wants to do as far as his policy is what he's going to continue to push for. Whether that works or not, I'm not quite sure. But I think the president is at a disadvantage, actually, politically, because he is not running for re-election again. So, you know, is he a lame duck? Does he? How much time does he have to actually use the bully pulpit before it becomes irrelevant on a political scene? So, again, I think that time frame of what he's working with is maybe his biggest enemy, that he's got this limited amount of space to be able to maneuver the Congress where he wants it to go.
But, I mean, one person's lame duck is another person's last term where you can kind of step up and say what you want to have said.
Right. You can be a lame duck.
Go ahead.
If you want to jump in here, Margaret. But listen, this guy is not a lame duck. He does not have a lame duck mentality. He's in fighting form. He's determined to push his agenda. He's going to go as far as the Congress will let him go with legislation. And then beyond that, he's going to use the executive powers of the president. If you know, we just come out of this period where we watched this movie, Lincoln. What we saw is that Abraham Lincoln decided that I will use the executive powers of my office to get things done that Congress won't give me. Bill Clinton did that to some extent, and we'll see a lot more of that from Barack Obama. This guy, he's determined, whether you agree with where he's headed or not, and sometimes I don't agree with where he's headed.
I know, I've noticed.
Sometimes I don't agree. But whether you agree with where he's headed or not, he's determined to try to get as far along the path that he's chosen as possible.
Margaret?
Go ahead, Amara, because it's always hard to be on the phone.
Go ahead, Amara, then we'll go to Margaret.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that strikes me, though, is that, you know, the State of the Union is not an accidental speech. It is the organizing principle for the government in the 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. There's nothing that anyone at the cabinet level or at the sub-cabinet level and below is focused on, but besides feeding in data to the White House on the State of the Union, putting forth proposals, and then having that go into the machine of a very structured process of coming up with what to say. And it's striking to me that the result of that is an immediate contradiction. It's a blank slate. He can do whatever he wants. It's his show, and it is the result of his government, right? And the thing that he comes up with right off the bat is two things that immediately cancel each other out. There was not a structured progression from one idea to the next. If you look at it, there's an open with compromise. He says that he wants to compromise. He gives a JFK quote of willing to compromise rather than fight. I mean, that immediately kind of sets up the wrong tone given this Congress and how he's gotten himself into a lot of trouble with them already. He then moves immediately to a call saying that it's his generation's challenge to reverse inequality and the economic disparity that has only grown and reached its height under his presidency. And then 2 minutes after that, he goes into the reality of sequestration, which cancels out everything else that he just said.
And that
to me is striking. It can't be overlooked, and it's concerning.
And yet the polling done after the speech among those who heard the speech showed that his approval rating increased. I'm not going to argue.
Yeah, but who's doing the polling?
In fact, there were several polls done. But here's the point. I'm not going to differ with Mario on this point, except to say that he offered something to different audiences. He had different audiences. He spoke to those different audiences, and what those audiences heard was what they wanted to hear. And those things that didn't interest them, they apparently, and even the contradiction you point out, they probably were not aware of. They didn't hear that. What they heard was what they wanted to hear.
Margaret, and then we're going to play a clip that we can rest
with. I call it political theater, because if you don't know anything about the economics, about what's going on in healthcare and education, you can listen to this speech and it sounds like things are really great and he sounds like we're stronger than we used to be, when in reality, I'm frightened by Obama's agenda. I don't want to see him push through his agenda. His agenda over the last few years has been maneuvering to cut Social Security and Medicare. And last night, he said again that he was in agreement with the Simpson and Bowles recommendation to raise deductibles, raise copays on our seniors who are already struggling to pay for their health care, many of them living in poverty, a growing number of them living in poverty, that he's open to reforms of Medicare and Social Security. We can only guess that those reforms are going to be to weaken them. He's been pursuing a Wall Street agenda on every avenue, whether it's, you know, housing, education, the economic system, energy, defense. And he was very strong last night that this has been a defense president. He's, you know, really bumped up our military spending. He's our weapons sales have gone skyrocketing. $26 billion prior to him, $76 billion in weapons sales over the last year. And his first thing when he started talking about these technology centers, innovation centers, they're going to partner with the defense industry. We don't need more weapons. So I'm not happy about the agenda that he's pursuing. And I think that people need to go into this with their eyes open and really look at everything that he's saying with a critical lens.
Duane, go ahead. Then I'm going to open with a clip here.
I'm smiling here because I am as liberal as I think they get. But I have to acknowledge there will be some cuts in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. There will have to be.
No, there don't have to be. That's the charade.
In the political world in which we live, yes. Okay. In another world that doesn't exist, maybe not, but in the political world in which we live, there will have to be some cuts, just as there will have to be some use of revenues generated by closing loopholes for infrastructure repair, for education. The Republicans want it all to go to deficit reduction. They're going to have to make some concessions there, and the president's going to have to make some concessions on Medicare and Social Security, or we'll never get out of this
hole. We're heading into a recession. Our GDP was down last quarter. Our consumer confidence index is down. The wrong thing to do when you're going into recession is to cut important social programs. We're heading down the same road that the UK is heading down right now with their austerity measures. They're going into a triple dip recession. We already know from the history in this country that if you start cutting government spending when you're in this situation, when our unemployment is rising, that you're going to take us deeper into a recession. So no, I don't agree with that political reality. I don't think that people should be told that we have to accept measures that are going to cause real growth and poverty, real suffering, and real death. What he didn't say last night when he was talking about the people that were killed from weapons is that over 120 Americans die every single day in this country because of lack of access to health care. But that is not mentioned, and that's not acceptable. But we're all told that we're supposed to accept it because that's the way the political reality is. I think we need to, as Americans, start challenging that a little bit more strongly.
So let me do this. Let me jump in. I can see Tony. I can hear Yamara about to jump in, and I can see Tony wanting to jump in. But let me play this clip where he talks about these modest reforms and come back and talk about that, all right?
In 2011, Congress passed a law saying that if both parties couldn't agree on a plan to reach our deficit goal, about $1 trillion worth of budget cuts would automatically go into effect this year. These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They devastate priorities like education and energy and medical research. They would certainly slow our recovery and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs. And that's why Democrats, Republicans, business leaders, and economists have already said that these cuts, known here in Washington as the sequester, are a really bad idea. Yes, the biggest driver of our long-term debt is the rising cost of health care for an aging population. And those of us who care deeply about programs like Medicare must embrace the need for modest reforms. Otherwise, our retirement programs will crowd out the investments we need for our children and jeopardize the promise of a secure retirement for future generations. But we can't ask senior citizens and working families to shoulder the entire burden of deficit reduction while asking nothing more from the wealthiest and the most powerful. We won't grow the middle class simply by shifting the cost of health care or college onto families that are already struggling, or by forcing communities to lay off more teachers and more cops and more firefighters. Most Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, understand that we can't just cut our way to prosperity. They know that broad-based economic growth requires a balanced approach to deficit reduction, with spending cuts and revenue, and with everybody doing their fair share.
So this is kind of talking to what we were talking about a moment ago, and I just because I wanted to play that to get us to remind our listeners what they heard last night. Yamara Jones, you wrote a piece for Color Lines this morning where you were talking about you can't have growth and austerity at once. So what's your comment on this?
I mean, what I hear in that speech is a president who is negotiating with himself, even as he lays out his principles, which I find really interesting. I mean, even if you accept that we have to have some sort of a compromise on spending cuts and revenues, I mean, and I think that there's a really strong argument to be made that the compromise has been one-sided. Already, if you 70% of the deficit reduction that's been accomplished already has been through cuts rather than revenue increases. If with the cuts that have already been made, the discretionary part of the budget, which funds a lot of the economic opportunity programs that the working poor, the working class, and people of color need in order to advance in this country, is on track as a result of these cuts already without sequestration to be at the lowest level as a percentage of GDP at any point in 50 years. That's where we're already headed. So I think there's a strong argument to be made that the balance has been one-sided but in the wrong direction. But even if you accept that we have to have more of that, you don't get there by compromising with yourself in public. You don't negotiate with yourself in public. And he's saying, well, we have to have a balanced approach, and, you know, even we can't ask more of seniors without asking more of the rich and all the rest of it. The way that you get to a balanced approach is to have two sides across the table which sharply disagree and which give at some point. But the president constantly takes his own negotiating position, which is about protecting the poor and the working class and the middle class, and always incorporates the other side's point of view in terms of protecting the 1%. And you can't do that at the same time and it come out right. And I think that we've seen the result of that as he's moved forward over the last 4 years. And it's so pronounced, as I wrote last week, that Nancy Pelosi has a name for it, and she calls it the Dance of the Seven Veils, where he goes to the Republicans and says, well, I'll come up off of established positions on all these other things. I'll give up all this other stuff. If you all give up on stuff, they initially say yes, but as the negotiations go forward, as she says, they transform themselves into a now you see us, now you don't type of interaction. And he's always left to dance with himself and is always left holding the bag. And his constituency is always the worse off for it. So, and I think that you just saw that replicated last night in that speech, in those few minutes, he's negotiating with himself in public in front of everyone else. And that can't be the way that the process works. And it's actually not the way that the founders and the Constitution wanted it to work. It's designed for us to come to compromise after some very severe fights, and that can't happen unless you have a person who's willing to clash on a grand scale, and oftentimes he's not willing to do that.
Folks, jump in.
Wow.
I'll follow Tony.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Bill Clinton back in the 90s was famous for triangulation. This guy's trying to pentagulate. Not only does he have the left and the right, but he's got the Tea Parties and the ultra-liberals that he's got to try to deal with, too. And kind of following Amari's point there is that you don't know where he's coming from. I mean, and we've heard this for at least the last couple of years, that there are people on the far left that are annoyed with this president as people on the far right are, because the folks on the far left think that he was supposed to do X, Y, and Z, and this president maybe isn't strong enough or has kind of the mindset in what he wants to really accomplish without trying to be nice to everybody. You know, so there's that. But the kind of thing that got me about the whole sequestration thing is, and I think, Mark, you mentioned this earlier, is that this was a compromise between the White House and House Republicans. This didn't come out of the blue. This was what we're going to do in 2011 so we can avoid this crisis, and then we move to 2012 to avoid the next crisis. And now we have a crisis in 2 weeks, and now it's well, you know, Republicans, Democrats, and me think that this is a bad idea, so we need to move beyond this crisis to get to the next crisis. Well, that is that's not strong leadership. You know,
Margaret, and then over to Dwayne before we go to break.
Well, you know, every crisis that we face right now, there are evidence-based solutions that would work. You know, we have a history of this country to know what works and what doesn't. What's very upsetting to me is to hear things like President Obama blame the deficit on the elderly, on their rising medical costs, because the actual cause of our deficit is not Medicare. It's the wars that we've been waging over the last 10 years. It's the cuts, tax cuts that we've given to corporations and to the wealthy. That's what's brought on this deficit. And so our seniors have no wiggle room. Poverty is rising among our seniors. Food insecurity. Over 70% of our seniors have food insecurity. Rising credit card debt. Credit card debt is the greatest for people over 55, greater than our young people have right now, and most of that is medical care. There's just no wiggle room there. Kevin Zeese and I published an article a week or so ago, said that we have to solve the twin crises of poverty, retirement, and health insecurity in this country if we want to have a recovery, and we do that by raising Social Security, by raising Medicare, and we show the argument of how those would work.
So, Dwayne, take us to break.
In politics, those who get to define the argument almost always win the fight. And Obama's trying to shape the argument. What are the other arguments? So the other argument is that Medicare didn't create this debt on the left. On the right, it is that excessive spending created the debt. And the left would say, yeah, but the excessive spending was done by the military. It is spending. Let's be honest. We spent more money than we had. That's why we have this debt. We spent more money than we had. And not only did we spend more money than we had on social programs. I believe in these social programs, but let's be honest about it. Social Security is not a function of what people pay into it. It's a function of what politicians decided people should get. So that if you were married three times and each woman to each partner to whom you're married, you were married for 10 years, a minimum of 10 years, they each get half of your benefit. Who pays for that? That's not a function of what you paid into it. It's a function of the political calculus that was thrown into it to shape giving at a time when we had a lot of money to give. Now we don't have that much money to give. We're going to have to draw back on all sides. Cut the defense spending. We need to slash it significantly.
I really disagree with that because we live in a country in which—
You disagree with that?
With cutting spending. We don't have to cut spending. That's misinformation. We live in a country where we can print money. We're printing $85 billion a month.
We can print
and giving
money?
That to, yes.
That, we that can, leads to inflation. You
no,
know, right?
It doesn't necessarily lead to inflation. If you No, you need to— You should read our article that we just published this morning on this.
So, Margaret, we have to take a break. We're going to come right back to our guest, pick up this thought. We're going to play the clip on fatherhood. We're going to play the clip on immigration. Stay with us as we analyze President Barack Obama's State of the Union address last night. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. As we continue our conversation about President Barack Obama's State of the Union speech last night, we are joined here in studio by Dwayne Wickham, chair of the communications department here at Morgan State University, a columnist for USA Today, a TV print journalist for the last 40 years. 30, give you too much time there, Dwayne?
30 years.
30 years, sorry, man. Tony Campbell, former major figure in the Baltimore County Republican Party, political science professor at Towson University. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician, physician, activist, co-director of itsoureconomy.us, and co-host of Clearing the Fog, a radio show. Imara Jones is economic justice contributor for Color Lines, served in the Clinton White House, where he worked on international trade policy, and former executive at Viacom. Let's just finish up where we left off for a moment about this argument about the spending
Zimbabwean
and deficit.
Well, approach to
when you live
printing money.
What'd you call it?
Zimbabwean approach to printing money.
Well, you know, when you live in an empire, you can run deficits that are 100%, 200% of GDP. The UK did it for 100 years, and they survived. We can do that. We do not have to make cuts. In fact, by making cuts to our necessary, life-saving social programs, we're going to hinder ourselves from being able to have economic recovery.
So,
can I just make a corollary argument?
And very quickly, ma'am, I want to move on to a new area, but go ahead, please.
Yeah, a corollary argument. the bottom line is that spending isn't a problem right now because the economy is anemic and is weak. Inflation's not a problem, so we can print money without there being a problem. That's a fact, and that's what the chairman of the Federal Reserve says, and he agrees, and that's why we've had a very loose monetary policy. So on the fact, on that point, Margaret is correct. And also, the bottom line is that as a percentage of GDP, the United States collects tax revenue at a lower level than any other developed country on the planet. Mm-hmm. We fund our government activities at the same level as Mexico. And what that means is that we don't have enough resources in order to be able to grow our economy strong and broad, because we can't make the investments that we need to make. And that shows up in falling living standards, particularly for the most vulnerable. And so as an economics fact and less about sort of economic theory, the bottom line is that as a fact, we spend less than anybody else. As a fact, it shows up in falling investment. As a fact, we have falling living standards and an anemic economy. If we are going to turn the situation around, we've got to start to invest. We're on track to spend less on these things than at any point in 50 years with the cuts that were already made. And if we want to have an economy that works for everyone, we've got to pay for it. And that's just the truth.
I'm going to concede that the economists, including Margaret, know what they're talking about when they proffer these theories about how much money we can spend, how much money we can print. It's fine to have that discussion in the academy. It doesn't work in politics. In the real world of politics, it's not going to work. We have a House of Representatives controlled by Republicans. The tail that wags the dog, you know, are radical Republicans of the sort not
from the 1880s.
Not from the 1880s. A new brand of radical
right.
Republicans.
Right.
You're not going to fly that kite by them. And so if you know you're not going to get it, but you can scream and holler and talk about this till you're red in the face, it's not going to happen. Not in this political climate.
Well, and not only that, but you also had a House of Republicans that less than 3 months ago approved a tax increase for the wealthiest Americans. And that budget deal, the one that got us over the fiscal cliff. So to expect that these people are going to increase taxes another time, 3 months afterwards, when you haven't even given any kind of real indication of what kind of modest reforms you're going to have to Medicare or Social Security or any other discretionary spending in this country, is ridiculous.
Well, one of the things they didn't talk about last night was the president hasn't talked about it. Nobody's talked about it. Was controlling health care costs as a key to controlling the deficit, not going after Medicaid and Social Security. But nobody's having that discussion.
Well, that was another area where he said health care costs are falling under the Affordable Care Act. They're falling because people are self-rationing. They're using less medical services because they can't afford it.
So that's a discussion
the
I think we have to pick up another day. I think that's a really important point we've all made. Let me play another clip that an entirely different subject the president raised. This is about fatherhood. A lot of people were kind of stood back when he said this. Let's play this clip.
And we'll work to strengthen families by removing the financial deterrence to marriage for low-income couples and do more to encourage fatherhood. Because what makes you a man isn't the ability to conceive a child, it's having the courage to raise one. And we want to encourage that. We want to help that. Stronger families, stronger communities, a stronger America.
Now, I know that when he said that, a lot of people, I saw a lot of posts on Facebook as soon as he said that. David Miller tweeted and said something about it immediately because of his work on fatherhood with the White House and separately. This is a huge issue for a lot of folks. And I think that his putting in there, Duane, said a great deal.
You know, what we know from the Children's Defense Fund is that children born out of wedlock have so many great disparities in their lives. They tend to be low weight. They tend to have educational deficiencies. They tend to get off to a slower start. They tend to have more problems in the juvenile delinquent system. They tend to be at a deficit from the beginning of life. And even programs like Head Start become catch-up for them because they're so far behind. It's painful to hear, but there's a lot of truth in this area. We've got to face this truth. I grew up in Cherry Hill in South Baltimore at a time in the 1950s, living in the projects when everyone on my block had a father and a mother living in the house. We were in poverty, but we had parents, two parents, and families existed and worked well in those situations. And quite honestly, we see that the one-parent family for most people, not for the wealthy, but for most people, is not the ideal situation for children.
That's an important distinction you just made. And I just want to remind folks that anybody can jump on that real quickly before we move to the subject. But the next week, by the way, I think is the 50th, if my math is correct, 50th, 60th, 50th anniversary of the Moynihan Report.
Mm. Mm. Right.
And they will be doing a show on that next week. There's going to be a huge conference in Washington. Michelle Alexander is speaking the keynote there. And we're going to explore that from the perspective of those of us who back in the day called him a racist. And then in retrospect, people going, he had a lot to say that nobody wanted to hear at that moment, and wrestle with what that report meant from back then in today's world.
And the best program for fathers is a jobs program.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things that's come out is that we've seen in terms of what the census has showed is that as a result of this recession, people are marrying less. Families are, there's a lot of pressure on families in terms of being able to make ends meet. That plays out in terms of relationships and all the rest. And it's actually harder for people to construct the type of lives that, some data suggest is what's best for children. And to me, it was, once again, is odd because one of the things that the president has never mentioned are the words black unemployment. He has never actually put those two things together in a sentence. And the same is true for Latino unemployment. And if you want to do something about the situation of encouraging black fathers to be able to take responsibility or fathers in general, then we need to have jobs. And that's also another disconnect in his speech.
And one of the things to jump into this about jobs, because we're going to play a clip right now that has to do with the minimum wage, so we can talk about that.
Before you do that, I want to say this because I'll get in trouble, but I need to say it. One of the biggest problems with fatherhood is also motherhood. Most black children today are born out of wedlock. They're not born to two parents where one parent leaves because they can't get a job. Most black children born in America today are born out of wedlock to mothers who are not married at the time. And so we also have to talk about motherhood, what it means to be a mother, and the responsibility that mothers have to bring children into this world, into loving, caring environments that can produce, I think, children who can maneuver through all the difficulties of life.
We're in poverty, people are in a skewed world.
Right. And we live in a time of great wealth inequality. You know, back when 1950s, 1960s, that was when the income disparity was very low. And now it's the greatest that it's ever been in our history. And so I agree completely with Amara. If we want to start supporting our families, we need to bring them out of poverty. We need to create a real education that's not pushing students out of the system who don't perform well into the prison pipeline. That's allowing students to go to college that they can afford instead of putting them into debt where they can't afford to have families or to have a home, they can't get a job when they get out of college. We've got to address those underlying issues and reduce the wealth divide. That's why we have our project, It's Our Economy, to organize towards democratizing the economy so people can actually have some control and benefit from our economy.
Unless you want to jump into it, I want to
find it interesting that, the president talks about fatherhood yesterday, and some people, think that it's maybe he's taking a shot at some folks. But, folks like myself, who is an African-American Republican, has been talking about this issue for 15, 20 years. And at times it's like, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You're an Uncle Tom. You're a racist. And we're talking about things that are going to, A, make the family stronger, help these young people to succeed, and that's kind of what America's supposed to be about, isn't it? Is success. But depending on where that dialogue is coming from, you can be Bill Cosby and be laughed at because you're 80 years old and maybe you've gone off the deep end in your later years. But if you're a Republican or you're white or you're Latino and you don't have that particular societal connection, you don't know quite what you're talking about. And so I think the perception is a little skewed too.
Well, I think it's a movement that has really kind of taken heart in a lot of communities in America. And I just don't mean the black community. It's taken heart in a lot of places there. It's happening in the Native communities, happening in like poor white communities, happening all over, where people are saying that fathers have to get involved. We have to deal with families. I was talking to David Miller about this the other night and realizing that it was in 1977 that we helped start a program. This is 1977, called Club for Expectant Mothers in our vocational high schools, which was to teach mothers, so they wouldn't drop out, teach young girls how to be mothers, but bring their fathers in, the fathers of the babies in, to learn how to be fathers, whether they're married or not. And so the issue's been exploding since then. And now it's at exponential levels with our children, and we have to address it. And I'm glad he raised the issue last night. Let's hear the piece on minimum wage. We'll come back to wrestle with that.
We know our economy is stronger when we reward an honest day's work with honest wages. But today, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year. Even with the tax relief we put in place, a family with two kids that earns the minimum wage still lives below the poverty line. That's wrong. That's why, since the last time this Congress raised the minimum wage, 19 states have chosen to bump theirs even higher. Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. We should be able to get that done. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families. It could mean the difference between groceries or the food bank, rent or eviction, scraping by or finally getting ahead. For businesses across the country, it would mean customers with more money in their pockets. And a whole lot of folks out there would probably need less help from government. In fact, working folks shouldn't have to wait year after year for the minimum wage to go up, while CEO pay has never been higher. So here's an idea that Governor Romney and I actually agreed on last year. Let's tie the minimum wage to the cost of living so that it finally becomes a wage you can live on.
That was an interesting clip, and I was kind of writing about that on Facebook when he said it last night. And what he's talking about is a wage of $18,000 a year.
Right.
And we had a debate on this show last week on the minimum wage. And where Corey McCray and others are trying to push in the state in Annapolis to have it raised to $10.25 an hour.
Bring us back to 1968 levels.
Which would bring us back to 68 levels. So the question of minimum wage is very critical here. But what do we mean when we talk about minimum wage? Because this is $18,000 a year. I don't think anybody in this room right now could even conceive, even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, of living on that kind of money. And that being a way out of poverty.
It's interesting because he campaigned in 2008 on $9.50 an hour for the minimum wage. And when he had that Democratic Congress, I don't think we heard too much about this. And now he's
Wasn't even a bill on the minimum wage.
To $9 an hour. Totally inadequate. The best part of that was tying it to the cost of living. But it's still a completely poverty inadequate minimum wage.
I'm not going to argue in favor of poverty, so don't look at me.
here's the thing that I found interesting. okay, go ahead.
but I find this rather remarkable. I've traveled the world. I've been to Cuba every year since 1999. And it's fascinating to see how these theories of capitalism and communism and how we argue about these different things. And at the end of the day, we all want what the other has. You go to Cuba, and where they have heavy social, the socialistic hand of government is heavy on the people pine for an opportunity to have the fruits of democracy. And you come here to our great country where democracy reigns supreme, and we pine for some vestiges of socialism. Mm. A minimum wage, which I support. I even support a higher minimum wage, but let's be real about what it is. It has no connection to the economy and the economic system in the sense that capitalism talks about rewards for productivity. It is ensuring that the least of us can survive in our society. I'm all right with taking from the rich and giving to the poor in this sense because the rich in this country are very rich.
And they became rich off of the commons.
Imar, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is I think that this discussion shows just how far our expectations of what America is supposed to be about have fallen. I mean, one out of three people that work in this country don't earn enough to live. That's one out of every three people that we ask to put in 40 hours a week at a minimum cannot live off of what they make. And the minimum wage actually needs to be a living wage. And economists say that at a minimum, the minimum wage needs to be maybe $12.50 an hour. If you actually index it, I think from the 1970s, it would be $23 an hour. It clearly needs to go up. It clearly needs to go up a lot more. But I think the fact that we're able to have an esoteric discussion about, you know, the way in which this wage is disconnected and all the rest of it just shows how pitiful our discussion is about creating an economy that works for everyone when it clearly doesn't. When we ask one out of three people in this country to work, pay taxes, go to a job, and they still can't earn enough to live, and we accept that. And that's just kind of where we are in America right now, and it's got to change.
So let me do this. I'm going to play one more clip, if we can get a couple more here. One of the big issues facing the last election and coming up in Congress will be immigration. So let's listen to President Barack Obama on immigration.
An ingenuity of striving, hopeful immigrants. And right now, leaders from the business, labor, law enforcement, faith communities, they all agree that the time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get it done. Now's the time to get it done. Real reform means stronger border security, and we can build on the progress my administration's already made, putting more boots on the southern border than at any time in our history, and reducing illegal crossings to their lowest levels in 40 years. Real reform means establishing a responsible pathway to earned citizenship, a path that includes passing a background check, paying taxes and a meaningful penalty, learning English, and going to the back of the line behind the folks trying to come here legally. And real reform means fixing the legal immigration system to cut waiting periods and attract the highly skilled entrepreneurs and engineers that will help create jobs and grow our economy.
So this is going to be clearly an issue that can be debated in Congress. This is going to be one of the issues that's going to be the battlegrounds. One of the things that struck me always about this, and you all can just comment as you see it, is that when you talk about people speaking English, that the one thing he said, it's when you talk about white immigration into America, nobody spoke English. My father's parents didn't speak English until the day they died. I spoke another language to them. That Germans in this country didn't speak English until 1917 when they were terrified to speak German so they wouldn't be killed during World War I. And Benjamin Franklin went crazy about it in the 18th century. But this whole kind of thing about English and going to the back of the line, I'm curious how we think about.
I actually have more concerns about the visas and, you know, what he's trying to do with the H-1 visas is to bring in more people from out of the country who have, you know, engineering and other professional degrees. But and the other piece of this immigration reform that he's putting forth is the guest workers. And that's a huge issue because guest workers permits are akin to slavery, modern slavery. These are people that come to this country and have absolutely no rights. They're workers in this country with no rights, and this law would expand that type of working condition. So these are areas I think that are really key that we need to be talking about that are not being discussed.
Tony?
I'm going to just – it's interesting that the president brings up immigration reform again when he had a Democratic Congress when he was first elected. And it wasn't even an immigration bill that was even offered at that point, which...
While he was deporting millions.
Right. So I don't understand that logic at all. But, again, I'm just a Republican, so things I don't
just
understand.
A Republican?
Just a Republican.
I mean, one of the things...
Wait. I want to transition, go back to the minimum wage, and then, sorry, and you can, like, in about 30 seconds. I think the one thing we have to ask is, it's not really government's responsibility to make sure that people have a living wage. I don't read that anywhere in the Constitution. Now, I understand that there needs to be a safety net, and we don't want people to starve and be in poverty. But should we count on our free enterprise system to be able to – that whatever your work is, as John Locke would say, that the fruit of your labor would then equal the amount of money that you receive because of the work that you produce, or – are we going to subsidize everybody to make sure that everybody is on the same level? I don't agree with that philosophy. I don't. But and then on then politically, so, how he kind of adds into it is that you don't bring up Mitt Romney's name to justify the fact that the Republicans should vote for it, because Republicans are trying to run away from Mitt Romney as fast as they can. So that's not a good justification politically.
Let me go to Duane.
Maybe I invoked the socialism argument too lightly the last time around. Listen, this question of democratic socialism was answered a long time ago. Social Security. Okay? So we settled that issue a long time ago. This nation has, and I think rightly so, decided that while we are a capitalistic society, that the wealth of this nation is sufficient enough to provide a floor, a safety net for the least among us. And now the question is, how high do we raise the net?
Right.
And I think that's what is in front of us now. The debate will be, you know, what do we do for the least among us? And we're going to have to do more than we've done if we want a society that is not in upheaval. If we don't want an American spring, then we need to provide for the least among us.
Let me go to Imar before we go to Margaret. And Imar, can you jump in? One of the things talking about free enterprise, but when people say that, what always strikes me is the conversations I've had in Dundalk over the last 5 years and in Turner Station on the east side of this town, where 30,000 steel workers who spent 25, 30, 40 years in the plant don't have a safety
right.
net. They lost everything because free enterprise ran the show and government didn't step in. So government allowed
these corporations to make those rules so they could pull out.
Well, that's true, too.
You want more government.
So you want more government. That's a good Republican stand. I like it. Imran, go ahead.
The bottom line, actually, in capitalism, and this is actually laid out by Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations. It's interesting how people who say that they support capitalism and free enterprise admit large parts of what the founding father of modern capitalism articulated. But the bottom line is that capitalism produced a lot of waste. There are a lot of inefficiencies in capitalism. And one of the inefficiencies that it has is the way that it treats labor and the way that it treats the environment and the way that it treats public goods. And a large part, the last third of his, 1,000-page tome is devoted to that the role of the government is actually to smooth out these inequalities, because without it, capitalism cannot function. It will actually fail. Capitalism left to its own devices without a strong government hand, and he advocates on education and on transportation and a whole host of other things, will actually eat itself. And we actually need government to be able to smooth out the inefficiencies of capitalism. And so actually Social Security and all of those other things were the attempts by Franklin D. Roosevelt to rescue capitalism from itself so that it could actually continue to garner public support right. so that it can continue to provide wealth.
Well, there is one issue that we haven't discussed, and I was surprised to hear him actually bring it up last night, which was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because this is a trade agreement that's we've been calling it a global corporate coup. Other people call it NAFTA on steroids. It's been negotiated in secret over the last 3 years, except for the 600 corporate advisors that have real-time access to the text. It's going to massively offshore jobs in this country. It's going to drive down labor, environmental, and consumer laws. It's going to give corporations, multinational corporations, greater power than individual nations. So I was surprised to hear him bring that up. People need to learn about this. They can go to flushthetpp.org and learn more.
10 seconds.
About the college report card, as someone who teach at
literally
the university level,
up, so.
I'm not comfortable with the administration deciding which colleges students should go to.
He's just going to help us figure out ones that don't put us in debt, though.
Exactly.
It's okay. I don't want to go in debt for my next college tuition for my kids. Anyway, I want to thank you all for being here. You just heard Dr. Tony Campbell, who's political science professor at Towson University. Duane Wickham has been with us, chair of communication studies here at Morgan State University, columnist for USA Today, and a veteran broadcaster in our community and country. Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of itsoureconomy.us, co-host of Clearing the Fog Radio. Imara Jones, economic justice contributor for Color Lines. And good to have you all with us. Thank you all so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
I want to remind you on our way out the door here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, wnecu.com. We're going to take a brief break, come back with traffic, and head on to our next conversation. Don't go away.